Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behind the badge.
All right. We ready to go? Everything's set in the booth. Levels are checked. Tape is running. Oh, what's that? Oh, that's true. We don't run any tape anymore. Not in the digital age. What do we say? Algorithms ready? Zeros and ones all stacked up? Binaries hot? All right, write it down on the board. Episode 125. Here we go. Three S's, Jim, as always. Star, smile, strong. Okay. Let's do this. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic. Right here at WGNplus.com. A new episode is posted every Monday at WGNplus.com for your listening and podcast pleasure. Thank you for swiping, scrolling, surfing, or whatever it is you do to find your way here on a weekly basis. Or perhaps you go to the landing page. Yes, yes. I have something called a landing page. At WGNplus.com, you go to the entertainment section, click on that, and you will find a prompt for Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and there you will find all previous 124 episodes of this podcast for your binging pleasure or to listen at your leisure, which then, of course, makes this episode 125. As I said, welcome to the podcast, and thank you for joining us this week. Wow, lots going on out in the world there. If you are watching the news, we are embroiled in one of the most controversial and explosive and divisive moments in history. And I don't think that's an exaggeration. I really don't. You know, sometimes we don't really understand or we don't even recognize that we are in the middle of history. Sometimes we do. I certainly wasn't around for Pearl Harbor, but certainly when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor and America entered World War II, I think everybody at that moment knew that that was a time of historical significance. In fact, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, good old FDR, even made the point in his famous speech when he asked Congress to declare war by saying, December 7th, a day that will live in infamy. And of course, things like 9/11, That was kind of this generation's Pearl Harbor when, again, America was attacked, this time really on its shores. Yes, there's no question that Pearl Harbor was an attack on America, but it wasn't on our shores. But as we know, 9/11 was at the heart of our country, and many consider the center of this country in terms of the biggest city and the most powerful city, New York City. So, yeah, there are times when we know that, this is important. This is history. And these last couple of weeks, if you haven't realized that, you should. It's harder now to discern what is important sometimes and what isn't, because we are inundated with so much information, not just on a daily basis or a weekly basis, but on a practically minute-by-minute basis, that it's at times, yes, it is hard to sift through this and decide what is important and what isn't, and what may be a moment in time, a moment in history, or may just be another passing moment, as so many seem to be with the way our dissemination of information now is so fast and so quick and so fleeting. We barely get a chance to digest one story, and there's another one waiting to grab our interest. It really is. We are living in a time, as I've said many times, of the shiny object that our attention is just turned to one way or the other. Where is the next shiny object of news that we will react to? But yes, this last past week or so, a couple of weeks, of course, I'm referring to the confirmation hearings and FBI investigations of the Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh. Now, as I am recording this, there has been no FBI investigation conclusion released yet. And there has been no vote on him. So please understand that I cannot be commenting or even referencing what, by the time this is posted, may be common knowledge. I am not Nostradamus, T-U-R, as in Toronto. I am not Nostradamus. I don't know what's going to happen. And I think anybody that has tried to predict what will happen in this entire Kavanaugh confirmation process couldn't help but be wrong. It has taken many, many unpredictable twists and turns, and it may continue. And they already may have happened while you are listening to this. So just I'm covering my bases by saying, sorry, gang. Full disclosure, this is not live radio, unfortunately, and so I am only reacting to and talking about facts that are on the table as I speak right now. But I'm not really here to talk about that, because I don't like to get overtly political. I certainly have my views on things. You have your views on things. But in today's world, to be honest with you, the slightest thing you say can spark an argument, and you really have no idea who's thinking what and where they are on a specific subject. We are really in a very tumultuous time, in a very specific time where it's everybody's all over the board. And so I don't like to get embroiled in that. You are hearing enough political talk in different venues, on television, on the radio, perhaps on podcasts. And what I like, hopefully, for this podcast to be is kind of a haven to escape from all of that. Because at one point, it just becomes a cacophony of opinions and shouting and views that are convoluted or things you've heard all the same. So I don't really want to get into that. But at the same time, it's not, it's impossible not to at least recognize what's going on. And as regular listeners of this podcast or regular listeners to me on the radio will know, I always try to find something in all the news that maybe no one else has thought of or no one else has recognized, or a little slice that may somehow revert back to me. Yeah, hey, I'm a narcissist. Who isn't these days, right? So Yes. I was watching a couple of weeks ago the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing with both Professor Blasey Ford and Judge Kavanaugh giving their sides of the story. And as I said, who you believe, what you believe, I'm not going to get totally into that. But one thing did stick out that was right in Elton Jim's wheelhouse. Did you pick it up? Did you notice it? If you're an Elton Jim fan, you should have. What have I talked about several times that I keep as a daily reminder? I've talked about this on the radio and on this podcast on several occasions. In fact, almost very recently, maybe a month or two ago, I mentioned this specifically. Judge Kavanaugh, in his defense, has produced his paper calendars from 1982, the time in question when he has been accused of assaulting this woman and Professor Ford. And so everybody was shocked initially. Why would he have these paper calendars from, you know, more than 30 years, 36-year-old calendars? Why would he have these? And why does he have it in the first place? Why would you even have a calendar at that time when you were, you know, in high school? Why would you keep a calendar of your events and your and the things that you did? And if you did keep it 36 years ago, why do you still have them? Why have you kept them and hid them away or put them in a bin somewhere and save them? Why do you have them? And once again, to a tech-savvy person, someone in their 30s or younger, you know, their question is, what is a paper calendar anyway? Well, there are those of us, I must be around the same age, I think, or around the same age as Judge Kavanaugh, just based on his years and his age of what they're talking about when this this alleged attack occurred. But when I saw the paper calendar suddenly become a new part of our pop culture, I was ecstatic. I'm not a fan or a detractor, as I said, of Judge Kavanaugh. This is not about liking him or not liking him. I was excited that the paper calendar and the day planner has been elevated and brought out of the ashes and out of the hidden view of the rest of the culture and brought back to prominence where it belongs. Ah, yes, there are those of us who still use a paper calendar. I have mine right here in front of me, my daily planner. And you may remember these if you've been in the workforce for many years, before the technological age, many employers used to give these out to employees for free. Do you want a daily planner? When I was at WGN Radio full time, Marlene Wells would come by and say, do you want a daily planner? Yes, I even used to get for our office the, remember the giant calendar that would be, that you'd put on the desk in a holder so your whole week and month was right in front of you on the desk, and then you would either fold it over or tear that piece off and the next month would be there and you'd fill in the dates. I even suggested we have one of those for our office, hang it up so everyone can see it. But I certainly have had my own. And whenever there was a specific date, something was happening personally or professionally, on the calendar. It's there. And for those questioning, it helps you organize. And I've said many times, I make a daily list of for the week on a daily basis. I make a list of things that I have to do that day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and there is no better feeling. Well, I shouldn't say that, right? No, but that's a great feeling. I'll just put it that way. There's a great feeling to put a line through one of those tasks that you have completed when you have your list. And then you look at the week that just passed and you said, wow, I got a lot done today. Or wow, I got a lot done this week. Or most importantly, I got everything I needed to get done today. Nothing slipped through the cracks. That's what these lists do for you, folks. And that's what a day planner does for you as well. Every week and every day, even though I have my small list that I put in my wallet that I make up on a smaller piece of like a post-it note, every day I will open up my daily planner book and check to see what's written there. Or when something comes up, oh, I've just made a doctor's appointment. I've just made an appointment to go to lunch. I've just made an appointment to do something else. Whatever it is, boom. Once that appointment is made, I go to the drawer, pull out the day planner, and whether it is next week or tomorrow or in 4 months, it's on the calendar. So I completely understand and completely could relate to Judge Kavanaugh as to why he had and still has his calendar. Now, you may say, okay, Jim, I get it. You have, maybe you're a little anal, and I agree. But as I said, I am very organized in that way, and it is very important for me that things don't fall through the cracks. I like to be punctual, and I like to be where I'm expected to be, and I like to be doing what I'm expected to be doing. So, you know, some people might just go with the flow. Once again, I'm criticizing, just telling you how I am. So, yeah, maybe I'm over planned out, or I've got, to your point, if you're thinking that, yeah, I've got two lists. I've got a list I carry with me and a list that sits as kind of the Bible in a drawer that is the backup. So, yeah, I'm covering all bases here to make sure that I know what I'm supposed to be doing or what I want to be doing or what's expected of me and what time and when it is. But people were questioning, well, why would the judge have this? Well, I'm explaining one reason why. Now, I did not have this in high school to this degree. I will tell you that. But I will tell you that into college, I did start to do this. Not the double and not the little daily list, but I certainly had a list written down. And I don't know about you, but I remember things when I write them down. I don't know if I have a photographic memory, or I don't know what that means, but all I know is that I can picture and visualize things on a page. That's why I was very good at memorizing in school and still memorize. I'm an actor. In fact, I'm currently in a play, and I can easily memorize. I look at it a few times and I begin to see the page and I know where those lines are and I can see the words. But I still use the backup. But yeah, I've been using a daily planner or a calendar for many years, and I will tell you where I got it from. I can once again close my eyes and picture it. My mom would have a calendar hanging right above the phone. In our house, there was a small little space where the phone was. You have to remember now, these are in the days of landline phones. That was where the phone was. We didn't have cell phones. There was a phone or a few phones, but in our house, we basically had one phone. Later, we had a couple, but for the most part, we had one phone. It's only three of us in the house. And yes, it had a long cord, so it can go to room to room. But above the phone, my mom had a calendar. My mom was a very busy woman. She was very active in a lot of different organizations and things. She was always going somewhere. And so I can talk about closing your eyes. I can close my eyes right now, and I could picture exactly where the calendar was. And I can see the calendar and her little notations of where, on what day things were. So that's where I certainly picked it up from. In fact, my mom has been gone now for, 12 years. But in cleaning out her things, I found a few of these calendars, and I still have one or two as a keepsake. So I've got her calendars. So that's definitely where I got it. And for those of you wondering, okay, A, why was, or I don't even know if he still does. I don't know if he does it electronically now. Obviously, these paper calendars are somewhat obsolete. It's not even that easy to find them anymore. There are a few, but there's, you have to go hunting a little. I mean, you go to some of the places like, some of the stationery kind of stores, the big box places, and they have a few different ones, but there's not a ton of them because most people are doing all of their planning or scheduling on their phones or on their computers. But there are those of us who still cling to the hard copy, the tangible. I like touching. I like touch. I like something tangible. And so I like having my daily planner. I like writing it down. As I said, when I write things down, it sticks in my mind. I don't know if it's the physical movement of the hand and the eye seeing it happen, but I remember things better when I write them down somewhere. But aside from why did Judge Kavanaugh have a paper calendar, the other question was, why did he keep one on a day-to-day basis? And I've tried to answer that for you. But the other question was, even if you had it, why do you have one from 36 years ago? I'll answer that. I don't have them from 36 years ago, but I certainly have them from 5 or 6 years ago. I keep them, and I don't know why. I know right where they are. I have a file cabinet. I have a stack of them from at least 5 or 6 years ago, and they are helpful at times as a reference. When did we go on that vacation? What year was that? When did I do this? When did I do that? In fact, what I will do on a yearly basis, and I've even done this on the radio, on a yearly basis, when the year is up, I will go. I will start at January and page through this calendar. And because I am very meticulous and put down most of the things that I do, whether it was appointments or whether it was vacations or whether it was get-togethers with people or parties or events or people's birthdays, it's all on here. I rarely forget a birthday. It's on here. I rarely forget an anniversary. It's on here. I rarely forget a meeting or an appointment or a get-together or a party. It's on here. I'm rarely, and so it's cool to then go back at the end of the year and go, wow. And I've said this before, too. I always look at a year, every January 1st, I look as if we get in our lives, and this is maybe philosophical, but I always look at it from the standpoint of, we've been given a new book, a new chapter with 12 blank pages. And it's up to us to fill those pages with memorable things, making memories. Yes, there are some of the mundane things. As I said, you've got your dentist appointments and your doctor's appointments and meetings. Yes, that stuff is there. But then, there's 365 days, and it's our job to make every one of those count. at least, you know, 100 or 200 of them, right? At least 150, 180, at least half, right? But we are given a blank page. And that is, you know, like I said, a philosophical thing. But then this day planner takes that away from being some kind of a thought to making it real. So when I look back after December 31st, I start to turn the pages. I go back to January and say, here was my year. And what did I do to fill it with memories, to create some milestones, to create some accomplishments, to fill it up as best I could? We only get so many pages, folks. We know the finality of life. And so I enjoy doing that. And like I said, I'm looking right now. Just started the October book. So I'm looking, even I just turned back a page here to, you know, I'm looking at September. And there's, you know, a haircut appointment and went to a relative's house, went to a couple of Elton John concerts, went to a Ravinia concert to see Johnny Rivers and Jimmy Webb. I had, as I said, a doctor's appointment for my eye. I was in a play in rehearsal most of September, so all the rehearsal times are on here. I was on the radio a couple of times with Dean Richards and filling in for different people on WGN Radio. My play started this month. Lots of different things that you may forgot. May have forgot. My godson's birthday was this month. As I said to you before, my mom's birthday and the day she passed away were both in September. All there for quick access to remember. I'm not overtly nostalgic, but I do think there is a value of looking back and remembering things, especially if, you know, they're good things. We always want to relive those things. And our memory is the only thing we have with those. Nowadays, everybody's recording things. I doubt many people are watching all the things they record. They're more interested in the act of recording them at the moment, sadly, instead of actually experiencing them live. That's a big cultural change. Before, that's all we had to rely on was our memory. And so we would take it in as much as we can to preserve that in our mind's eye. Now, sadly, many people's memories are not even firsthand. Their memories are through the phone first. They're looking at history. They're looking at stuff through their phone. They're not even looking at it. Just lift up your eyes. You'll see it for real. But they're so worried about capturing it on their phone that they don't get a chance to experience it. And I'll tell you, there's something to be said, because you can always take those memories with you wherever you go. So I had to laugh when I saw the paper calendar suddenly elevated into the national consciousness and all the questions being raised, and I felt very at home and very connected, at least to some way, to this moment in history. In fact, as I said, I'm not going to get into the politics of it, but I will now always remember the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings. In many, you know, aside from the political aspects of it, I will always remember because it brought up the idea of the paper calendar. And as I said, I look at October, and I've already begun to. And as I said, the great part of it too is it's good and bad. I'll tell you, the great thing, as I've just mentioned, the great thing is that you've got everything you've got to do and everything you have done in this one book. And so it's a nice way to come back. Now, I understand. And yes, I remember back in the 90s when the what did they used to call it? The personal assistant Remember? One of the first popular technology devices that really, you know, in the 90s when things started to really percolate, if you remember, was the Pilot. Remember the Pilot? Palm Pilot? The Palm Pilot was a small device that you would first touch, and it had a little stylus, and that was where you could keep your dates and your appointments. It was first, you know, targeted to the business person, and everyone had a Pilot. Then obviously later on it became obsolete because the phone just took over all of these kind of individual products. But yeah, remember the Palm Pilot? The Palm Pilot was there to put the good old Daily Planner out of business. Well, I can proudly say that I never had a Palm Pilot. I was offered one at my job. In fact, I worked in the technology world for 10 years. Still never had a Pilot. Oh my gosh, I remember going to meetings. People would, it was a status symbol, of course, just like the BlackBerry was, and now that's gone by the wayside. And before that, remember the pager? Remember the pager? Look at how far we've come in the last 20 or 30 years. Do you ever see a pager anymore? That's my point. All these other products everybody has to have, and they're the cool thing, and their status symbols, they all go away. But meanwhile, Daily Planner, still around, old school. But yeah, the Palm Pilot was there to get rid of this Daily Planner, and you have to have it carrying around. It was always big. Here you have this little thing in your palm, right? Palm Pilot. But now that's all done by, you can do that on your phone. You have a calendar, you have an alarm, you have all the other stuff, or you can do it on your tablet or your PC. I just like having the good old paper thing. But yeah, there's always been a way for people to, you know, have their schedule at their fingertips. And so for me, I'm still old school in many ways, and I'm proud of it. I certainly acknowledge the convenience of some things, but in my lifestyle, in the lifestyle that I have created, I don't need to. I've never that. That's the one thing. I've always been very immersed in the pop culture. Ironically, whatever is trending, whatever has been the trend, whatever has been the fad, I run away from. I don't. When everyone does it, I like to be an early adopter. I like to be ahead of the curve, but once it gets down to the average person, then I run away from it. So whatever becomes overtly popular, I run away from. I even ran away from Bruce Springsteen in 1985, who is one of my favorite performers and entertainers of all time. But in 1985, he got so popular that, you know, 10-year-old kids were all of a sudden singing Born in the USA, and I'd been a fan of Bruce's for, you know, by that time, 10, 12 years. I was there when no one knew who he was. And he got so popular. Little kids were dressing up like Bruce with the headbands, and, you know, 60, 70, 80,000 people were going to see him at outdoor stadiums and giant festivals. And I was like, no, that's not the Bruce that I like. And actually, the funny thing is that Bruce didn't apparently like it either. Because after 85, he way, way scaled down his entire career. But my point is, even things that I treasure, if they get so popular, I run away from them. I've always been that way. I don't know why. So I don't get the new gadget. I don't need it. And I certainly partake in the technological revolution and in technology, right? I'm recording this podcast. I'm recording it on my computer. So, yeah, I've got more than a toe in the pool. But I'm not completely immersed. And I honestly don't feel I'm missing anything. And when I do, then I do go to a next level. I talked many times several years ago, I didn't have any streaming services. And then I was watching the Emmy Awards last couple of years, and I was noticing that I didn't have access to any of the shows. I was feeling left out. So yeah, then I jumped into the streaming world. But I don't just get it for the sake of getting it. Some people just, oh, it's new, I have to have it, whether they need it or not. And I've always said, I believe that much technology today is not because we need it, but it's because we can do it, because we can, not because we have to, because we can. And to me, that's a luxury. Not just because I like to have, you know, gadgets or appliances or whatever, because I need them. Not because I can. Because if there's another way to do it that I'm used to, why change? Unless it is markedly better. And then I will change. So I'm not stuck in the past, or I'm not adverse to technology or advances. But I just don't do it for the sake of doing it. So you will. I have never had a Palm Pilot. And in fact, I just was playing around with my flip phone, good old flip phone. I discovered even more things. I have a calendar on there. I could put things in my little flip phone, which I never even knew I had. When this whole calendar thing came up, I said, geez, I wonder if my phone has that. So not only do I have bowling and Tetris on it, and I just found out a little while ago I have an alarm to wake me up, which is cool, and even a flashlight, which I didn't know was there. But now I discovered that I have a calendar too. I could even maybe do some of the stuff I do with my paper calendar on my phone. But guess what? I won't. So I get it, Judge Kavanaugh. I get why you have a paper calendar, and I get why you keep it. And I, as I say, am a proud keeper of the Daily Planner. And as I look today, it says record podcast. And that's exactly what I'm doing. I also wanted to quickly talk about this whole topic of, or address something of the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings. As I said, when I'm recording this, there has been no vote. There has been no FBI report yet. So I don't know what will have been said maybe by the time this posts for you to hear it. But what I will say is that a couple of weeks ago, if you were watching Saturday Night Live, you saw they did a skit about the hearings with Matt Damon playing Kavanaugh. And it was pretty funny. And there was a reference to the Crucible. I don't know if you heard that. Kate McKinnon was portraying Senator Lindsey Graham, who was railing, if you remember, at the hearings. He was railing and screaming at his fellow senators for what he felt was, you know, attacking Judge Kavanaugh and railroading him. And he was very upset. He's a Republican, obviously, so that's why he was doing that. But in the Saturday Night Live skit, Kate McKinnon's portrayal recreated that and obviously over-exaggerated and added some crazier things for the comic effect and made a reference by saying, and I'm also, and not only is he being railroaded, but I am also... auditioning for a regional production of The Crucible. And my ears turned up at that. And I was wondering how many people got the reference and why they got the reference. And the reason is twofold. I am currently performing in a production of The Crucible. When this posts, that production will have finished. But as I said, I've been in rehearsals for the last 6 weeks, and we've done several performances of it, and the show will have closed by the time this posts. But I have been in a production of The Crucible. And when we began to do the rehearsals, this play was somewhat timely. You could maybe connect some dots to the Me Too movement. Now, here's a little background. If you don't know, if you didn't get the reference on Saturday Night Live, let me explain to you. The Crucible is a play that was written by the noted playwright Arthur Miller. He did Death of a Salesman, View from a Bridge, The Crucible, one of America's greatest playwrights. He was married to Marilyn Monroe. He was one of the most well-known people in the 50s and 60s, Arthur Miller. So what this play was about specifically was, or is, the Salem witch trials of 1692. And if you may or may not know about this, but there in Salem, Massachusetts, in reality, there was a theocracy in this country when the Puritans came over. You know, there was people from England that left for religious freedom. They were Puritans. They were very religious in their adherence to the Bible. The Bible was the law. Their law, when I say theocracy, it's a law based upon the teachings of the Bible directly. Whatever the Bible says, that's the law of the land. And we still see many theocracies around the world, in the Middle East and other places. So in 1692, don't forget now, if you're using the Bible as a law book, the Bible certainly mentions the devil. And so these people firmly believed in the devil and firmly believed that the devil was at work on a daily basis, and his evil powers had to always be put in check. They were always at work. And for many reasons, political, culturally, personally, in Salem, Massachusetts, the real Salem, Massachusetts, which exists today, over several months, young girls in the community began to say that they were possessed by witches and the devil, and that people in the community were witches themselves, and that they were casting spells and they were doing the devil's work upon other people. And if people got sick, or if their animals died, or in many cases, you know, especially at this time, a lot of children died in childbirth. If your child died, you were looking for a reason. You blamed the devil. And then what was happening, a hysteria was going on. Well, this woman was a midwife and my baby died in her hand, so the devil's doing her work. This is the kind of hysteria that was going on. And it did go on for several months, and many people were killed. They were hung for being witches, males and females, mostly females. This was a real thing. And you can look in the history books. And it's a commentary on religious fervor and on prejudice and on jealousy and on vengeance. And it was ironic that here was this supposedly religious town, and yet they were breaking every rule by acting as if they were following the rules of the Bible. But they certainly were not following the rules of Jesus. Do unto others, the golden rule. So it was a crazy time. It was finally put to an end, but what's ironic about it is this happened in 1692. I think 19 people were executed for being witches, and two dogs. That's how crazy things got, folks. This is history. This is in the books. It wasn't until, I think, 2001 or so, into the 2000s, 310 years later, 300 years later, that the government of Massachusetts acknowledged that these killings were wrong. Crazy time. Flash forward to 1953, right? 300, 285 years later or so. 260. We have the McCarthy hearings going on. And this country is very paranoid about its place in the world with communism. And you and Joe McCarthy, the senator from Wisconsin, trying to drum up support for himself, as well as putting fear in people's minds that the United States was going to be overcome by communism because we were so afraid of the Iron Curtain. And this is, you know, post-World War II and right in the, you know, the Korean War. We're all worried about the dominoes falling and the communists taking over the world. And so he was alleging that there were communists throughout the American government and in many aspects of our society. And it became, and the term was called a witch hunt, calling people out just like they did in Salem without any proof. And these committees, McCarthy hearings, were bringing up people and saying, hey, are you a communist? No, I am not. Well, do you know any communists? Have you ever met any communists? And if you do, who are they? And people would say, look, I'm not here to get anybody else in trouble. Well, if you don't tell us, then we are going to put you in jail. Or as it seeped and continued for a few years, it certainly affected the entertainment community. And of course, that was high profile, which helped make headlines for Joe McCarthy. And so many of the Hollywood stars of the day were suddenly called upon to go to his committee, just like we saw Judge Kavanaugh and Professor Ford be questioned. Do you know a communist? Ever been to a communist party, a communist meeting? Do you know any people that have gone? And that became the line of questioning, and it became that if you didn't give up yourself or give up your name, a name of people, you would be blacklisted. Many people in Hollywood were blacklisted. They could not get a job. It was an unwritten rule that, oh, you don't hire this person. He may be a communist. There were agencies that were doing background checks on people. No proof, lots of paranoia. The same thing that drove the witch trials in 1692, in 1953, seemed to be driving this Joe McCarthy anti-communist movement to the point where Arthur Miller and many of his friends were called to the committee to pronounce their own patriotism and to give up names of people that they may know who were communists. And so it became a very tense period of time because people had to decide their very careers could be destroyed forever if they did not. They could be sent to jail. This was serious stuff. And it became about give us the name, give us names, give us names. There's a great movie by Woody Allen called The Front, which I think you can find on Netflix and other places that really plays into this. And it's not a Woody Allen film, but it stars Woody Allen. It was written by someone who was blacklisted. And many of the actors in the movie were blacklisted during this time. So there's an interesting symmetry. And it shows you just how divisive and how detrimental this period in time was in American history and how it ruined people's lives and ruined people's careers and ruined people's friendships. Many people killed themselves. It was not a very proud time in our history. And so Arthur Miller, the playwright, was experiencing this firsthand with himself as well as in his circle of friends. And he recalled that when he was in college, he learned about the Salem witch trial, and he came back to them for some reason. As he studied them again, he realized how similar things were in 1692 with these allegations of witchcraft and people being witches, many of them being called out for being witches so that people could take their land. If they went to jail, they could, their land would be taken away. Or if you had a vendetta, if you didn't like somebody, all of a sudden someone called someone a witch. And don't forget, there were young women who were the main perpetrators of this. Well, in that society, women, and especially young girls, they didn't even rank in the society. But suddenly they were given new prominence because they were calling out witches. So we've had in our times these times of paranoia and vengeance and revenge and hysteria and driven by other motives where we have been very hurtful to other people, as I said. So Arthur Miller wrote The Crucible as something of an allegory of what was happening in 1953, using the Salem witch trials as an allegory for the same kind of hysteria and unfairness and the detriment it was doing to people's lives and the telling, the tattletaling, if you will, on your neighbors and the sanctity of your own name to be clean and cleared that was being soiled by someone with no evidence whatsoever. And that was the allegory. It's called the crucible because a crucible is an area or something where there's intense heat or intense pressure. And so, in Arthur Miller's view, Salem in 1692 was a crucible. It was a place of intense heat and tension and pressure of what was going on in this community, how it was destroying this community, neighbor against neighbor, friend against friend. And so I was not surprised to hear this reference to the crucible on Saturday Night Live, because once again, I was watching the Kavanaugh hearings, and I'm totally immersed in this play. I play the judge who decides whether these people will be hanged or not. He is totally believing in the Bible as being the law of the land and the word of God. And so he believes in the devil and he believes the girls and he believes all these allegations. And that's why he's the guy that was hanging all these people, because, well, if someone said they were a witch, they were a witch. And there's a famous speech by the main character, the main protagonist, John Proctor, who was a real person. I should tell you that when Miller wrote The Crucible, he used many of the real names of the people that were involved in these trials and were involved in the whole situation, but he changed, it is still fictionalized. He changed the goings on for dramatic purposes to get his point across about the allegory and the metaphor for the McCarthy hearings of the 50s. So The Crucible is not a historical play. It is based on history, but the action is fictionalized. Many or most of the characters are real, and some of the things that happened really did happen. But the main, I guess, conflicts and the main action, and obviously the dialogue, was written, was fictionalized and written by Arthur Miller. It is an intense and thought-provoking and just riveting play. And to be acting in it is a great honor, to be able to be saying Arthur Miller's words and to be sort of conveying this Miller's message to audiences today. This play, ironically, it was just referenced, so it just goes to show you its relevance. This play was written in 1953. That was 65 years ago. And it showed itself to be as relevant today as it was in 1953, and it was based on something that took place in 1692. Same kind of circumstances. Allegations, denials, hysteria, political overtones, vengeance, revenge, all the same things. The Kavanaugh hearings had all those of the same kinds of aspects that were in the McCarthy hearings in the 50s. And yes, even in the Salem witch trials in 1692. How far have we really moved, folks? And as I said, there's a very well-known monologue by John Proctor, who is going to be hanged because he will not tell on his friends. Arthur Miller wrote this because he did not name names, and he was officially convicted of treason. And but he, you know, when the trials were proven to be false, and Edward R. Murrow, the journalist, basically did a series of reports that showed what a fraud Joe McCarthy was, and so this all washed away very quickly, just as the Salem witch trials did. When it was proven how the girls and the young girls were frauds, they all went. These trials went away very quickly because obviously logic took over. And so there's a famous. So Arthur Miller did not go to jail, but he did not name names. But people that friends of his, good friends of his, noted people in the entertainment industry did give names. In fact, Elia Kazan, who directed Death of a Salesman on Broadway, and some of the greatest movies ever made, like Streetcar Named Desire and 12 Angry Men. He did name names, and Arthur Miller was very disappointed that Kazan had done that. But Kazan was just trying to save his career. That was a difficult line that people were faced with. Miller did not name names, and so he basically said, through Proctor, his character, he was showing how this person was tempted to give names and tempted to lie that he knew that people, or that he was the devil, or he'd seen the devil, to save his life and to save but at the end, he couldn't. He couldn't lie because he says in this famous monologue before he's killed, he's hanged, "Leave me my name. What do I have if not my name? It's my name. It is the only one I have." It is a stirring moment. It's a great monologue, and it really came down to both Professor Ford and Judge Kavanaugh. They were both in those hearings, fighting for their credibility and fighting for their name. In fact, you remember, according to the testimony, Professor Ford did not want her name put out. She wrote a letter to Senator Feinstein and said, "I want to be kept in anonymity." And then her name was leaked to the press. And Judge Kavanaugh said, "I want to clear my name." When I heard both of them talk about that, it sent a chill up my spine. I said, "Oh my God, it's The Crucible." And 2 days later, Saturday Night Live referenced The Crucible. So if you didn't get that reference, I just wanted to give you a little background on it because it certainly was very pertinent to me, because right in the middle of this, I'm doing the play The Crucible. And I think if you, and regardless of me doing it, I would urge you all to either find the play itself and read it, or better yet, there is a movie of The Crucible that was made in the mid-90s with Daniel Day-Lewis and Winona Ryder. So it's on Netflix or somewhere out there. So, and Arthur Miller wrote the screenplay, 40 years after he wrote the play. So if you've never heard of The Crucible and you've just maybe heard the name but don't know what it's about, I would urge you, especially in the light of what's just happened now with this trial, to either read the play, or if you're not into reading plays, go see find the movie somewhere out there. You have to have access to it. The Crucible movie, Daniel Day-Lewis and Winona Ryder. It's an excellent version of the play and of the story by Arthur Miller. And if you do see it, my character was the judge, the main judge. I think Paul Scofield played the judge. But anyway, so I've had a great time doing that play, and it was just amazing how in this trial, these hearings between my paper calendar notebook day planner and a play that I'm doing for reasons not even political, had nothing to do with my thoughts on this entire situation, but just through these trials, things like this day planner that Judge Kavanaugh had, and references to and similarities to The Crucible, of which I had been studying closely for the last month and performing right in the midst of when these trials were going on, certainly made this this moment in history come to life and have a little more meaning for me. So the takeaways on this: go out for 2019 and buy a daily planner, a day planner. You could probably, I usually buy one for the next year sometime in October, November. That's by the time they usually start to be at the stores. Or go online, get a day planner for 2019 and see how you like it. Will you physically write stuff down? So A, here's your to-do list based on today's podcast. A, for 2019, buy yourself a paper day planner and fill it out. Put everybody's birthday and put their anniversary to start out the year. And then as you start to do things, write it in there. By the end of the year, you'll have fun reliving your past year. And while you're using it, I guarantee you will be very organized and you will not miss or forget appointments and dates. And takeaway number two, The Crucible. At the very least, if you don't want to read the play, check out the movie with Daniel Day-Lewis, The Crucible by Arthur Miller. You will surely tell us the name. And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic here at WGNplus.com. Every Monday a new episode is posted. I hope you will continue to join us every week for whatever this is. Your loyalty is much appreciated. I am Jim Tarano. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, from the end of the web to your screens.